Supreme Court of Texas is now in session pursuant to adjournment.
Thank you. Be seated. This morning, the court has three causes on its oral submission docket. In the order of their presentation, they are as follows. Lavina Rogers and others versus Retain Enterprises Incorporated and others from Cochran County. Texas Farmers Insurance Company versus Richard R. Soriano and others from Duval County. And Henry J. and Todd versus City of Deer Park from Harris County. The court has allotted 20 minutes for each side to present argument in the first cause and 25 minutes for each side to present argument in the second and third causes. We will take a brief recess in between the presentation of each of these arguments and will conclude the arguments before the noon break. These arguments are being recorded for the court's convenience. If you desire to listen to a tape of the arguments, you may make application with our clerk. The court is now ready to hear argument from petitioners in Rogers v. Retain Enterprise.
May it please the court,
Mr.
Robert Baxter, Jr. will present argument for petitioners. Petitioners reserve 7 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, my name is Bob Baxter, and I am counsel for Western Drilling, a corporation, and the Rogers Group, who own the stock of Western. We are plaintiffs and petitioners. As the court knows, this is a trespass to try title case in which the Rogers Group claims ownership of a 329-acre part of a 7,800-acre oil and gas lease on behalf of Western pursuant to a 1949 farm-out assignment from Superior Oil, which owned the lease at that time. The Rogers Group proved its ownership and title prior to trial by, among other reasons, stipulations and admissions that Western is the common source of title. The defendants trespassed on the property and converted oil and gas production, and as a result of Western's title being proven, tried to figure out a way to undermine Western's title. And for the past 9.5 to 10 years, that's what this case has been about, with defendants trying one theory after another, often inconsistent, to try to somehow unprove Western's title. One set of defendants' theories tried to show that Western's rights under the 1949 assignment terminated or lapsed, despite the fact that for 4.5 years prior to our suit, while defendants were trespassing and converting our property, they claimed they were successors to Western's rights under our chain of title and the 1949 assignment, and Superior Oil, which is not a party in the case, executed ratifications confirming the assignment had not terminated. Defendants' termination theories included a Texas Company versus Davis cessation of use, claim termination in paragraph 5 of the 1949 assignment, abandonment, and latches. These theories were all eliminated by this court's prior opinion, but defendants caused the trial court to disregard this court's opinion and reinserted those issues in the trial, basically gumming up the works of trial in a number of ways. In disregard of this court's opinion, the Court of Appeals again ruled the 1949 assignment terminated by Texas Company versus Davis cessation of use. However, since our briefing details the substantive reasons why this court's opinion correctly ruled out defendants' theory of termination of the assignment, since we believe this court's opinion was clear on that issue, we would intend to make only a couple of comments in our few minutes of argument, unless the court has questions for us on that issue. And we expect to focus on why the other four defense theories do not apply as a matter of law, thus allowing title to be rendered for Western and the Rogers Group without a necessity for remand on that issue. Rendering on title automatically resolves other main issues, including conversion liability, damage amounts, including specific amounts of damages, and affirmation of certain punitive damage awards that were granted to petitioners. If we cannot persuade this court to render for us on the major issues rather than remand, we will, as a practical matter, probably have lost this case, since I have used up all, and in fact, really more than all, of my available resources in surviving the defendant's litigation strategy and preserving and framing the issues for argument before this court today. We expect to limit our comments to approximately 10 to 12 minutes, since we would like to save 8 to 10 minutes for rebuttal due to the fact, although we've reduced it down to 7 now, defendants up to this point do not appear to have addressed most of our fundamental points in their briefing. With respect to the Texas Company versus Davis cessation of use theory, we think defendants should have to explain why they could argue to the trial court that this court did not deal, in their words, with that issue in its opinion, When this court reversed the summary judgment granted to defendants in our last appeal after acknowledging that that was the sole ground for the Court of Appeals opinion, and after quoting the rule that summary judgment would have had to have been affirmed if any ground had been valid. With respect to the defendant's theory of termination under paragraph 5, we have three comments. First, the summary judgment in the prior appeal was granted on all grounds, and the paragraph 5 theory was the only ground in the main motion of defendant Rakain, which was joined in by all defendants. The trial court granted that summary judgment on all grounds urged, and the trial court and defendant Rakain admitted on remand that the summary judgment had been granted on the paragraph 5 ground. Secondly, as this court noted in its opinion, the rule of Dallas Power and Light versus Claghorn and many other cases, in the context of this case, prevents additional termination remedies from being implied when the 1949 assignment already has expressed termination events. And applying the Claghorn rule to this case, how can a right for Superior Oil to terminate the assignment by written notice at its option be implied in the paragraph 5 for an alleged breach by failure to notify Superior Oil under that paragraph, when paragraph 6 also has a consent or notice provision and an express termination remedy, giving Superior the optional right to terminate for breach and failing to notify and obtain Superior's consent under that paragraph? Never mind the express termination event under paragraph 1, which was noted in this court's prior opinion. Thirdly, paragraph 5 has a requirement that production be developed before that paragraph applies. It is conclusively admitted on this record that production on the property ceased while Western was operating the only well, and that Western continued in possession after production ceased. Under paragraph 5, if there was existing production on the property and Western wanted to abandon or surrender that production, it had to notify Superior Oil, and Superior Oil had the right to turn down the proposed surrender. It had that option. However, under paragraph 2, Western had the unqualified right to surrender to Superior. I'm talking about the language down here. Any drilled and non-productive part of the property, or any part or all the property, whether drilled or undrilled, with no veto power or right to turn the surrender down by Superior. Consequently, if paragraph 5 were interpreted to apply to any situation other than where there is existing production on the property, it would make paragraph 5 either inconsistent with paragraph 2 or superfluous if paragraph 2 is given its plain meaning. That is, that Western had the right to surrender part or all of the property at any time without Superior's approval. Neither of those interpretations is permitted under the applicable rules of contract and leasehold construction that this court has set down and that are included both in its last opinion and in our briefing on the prior appeal. Of the four remaining theories of defendants, good faith purchaser is eliminated because that defense is inapplicable to a conversion case, period. We cited a number of authorities in our brief, and defendants haven't responded to any of them. Of the other three defense theories, all are related to the 1960 assignment by E.P. Campbell. Although Campbell owned possibly up to 12.6% of Western stock and was an officer and director, that assignment was only of whatever all right, title, and interest he might personally or individually own, if any, in the leasehold, with a disclaimer of warranty of title, and was made to another corporation, Dakota Company, in which he was a stockholder and president, but the majority stockholders of Western were not stockholders, nor officers or directors. Clearly, this document on its face does not convey any of the ownership interest of Western in the property, and even defendants' title opinions and internal documents acknowledge that fact. There's plenty of evidence in the record to show why someone such as Campbell would make a quick claim such as this, but it really does not matter to the issues under discussion. Defendants had to have and find some after-the-fact and after-lawsuit theory to leap across the gap from Western's record ownership of this property to Campbell individually, since they claimed under a chain of title coming from Campbell individually. They tried to claim a lost deed, but the jury ruled against them, and they gave up on their theories of agency and mistake. Although there are harmful errors in the questions and instructions that mandated the jury's answers on the three remaining defense theories without regard to what the facts of the law were, I will skip those because they only lead to a remand. Instead, out of the multiple arguments in our briefing, I would like to mention at least one argument on each theory that hopefully will cause the defendants, for the first time really before a court, to have to defend at least that part of each of its theories. Defendants claim ratification of the 1960 quitclaim by Western. However, first, nobody other than Campbell even knew about it. Secondly, even if other Western officers or directors had known about it, they had no duty to do anything about it or to disavow it, since it had no legal effect to convey away any of Western's interest in the property. And third, there is no evidence that Western ever ratified that quitclaim, and instead the evidence shows that after the quitclaim was executed, Western continued to operate the property and sell the production for Western's account to Magnolia, which is now Mobil Oil. 2 years after the quitclaim and Campbell's death, Western listed the property in its ownership summary and offered it to Western's creditors, as reflected in post-judgment discovery and deposition testimony from the 1960s. Third, a deed of trust was executed after the 1960 quitclaim, and that deed of trust by Western, and that deed of trust in an earlier one by Western, subsequently were released after the loans were paid off. As to estoppel by deed, that theory does not apply to quitclaims. Both the 1960 deed of trust from Dakota to Campbell and the transfer of that lien by Campbell to Union Bank Credit, as well as the next assignment by Bank Credit to Allred, and all the assignments by Allred to the defendants Toriana, Ortega and Kraft, Rakane, and other defendants, were all quitclaims, and those are documents under which all defendants claim title. They were all right title and interest assignments that convey only whatever title the grantor may have had, rather than any definite or current interest in the land itself. Although we believe the 1960 Campbell quitclaim was also a quitclaim, it's really not necessary to consider that issue since title flowed back through Campbell when the deed of trust to Dakota was foreclosed and then emanates out of Campbell again under the first two documents we had mentioned in our description. As to reverse alter ego, defendants are logically required to and do assert that Campbell, as an insider officer of the corporation Western, in executing the 1960 quitclaim, basically tried to misappropriate corporate assets of Western for his personal benefit, which would breach his fiduciary duty to Western and its shareholders. And defendants only claim the title as his successors to the chain of title that begins with this alleged attempted breach of a fiduciary duty. And I would refer you to their most recent briefs filed on Friday of this last week and page 3 to see how they describe that particular transaction. Nevertheless, the defendants want this court for the first time to apply a reverse alter ego theory, which is a theory that has to be based in equity, to the 1960 quitclaim for the purpose of binding Western and its majority shareholders to the expressly individual act of Campbell in the 1960 quitclaim and in essence validating an act alleged to be in breach of fiduciary duty against them. And for whose benefit are these innocent bystanders, Western and its majority shareholders, to be punished by taking away their corporate property under this equitable doctrine? None other than the defendants as successors to the very act they claim is wrongful. Clearly, this doctrine does not make sense in the context of this case. Also, defendants cannot show any evidence on the essential element of reliance by them from any claimed deception or misleading as to Campbell's status or capacity vis-a-vis Western at the time they trespassed and converted, over 18 years after the 1960 quitclaim and Campbell's death, especially when they all claim through multiple quitclaims in their chain of title that as a matter of law put them on notice of every defect in their title. And since all the title opinions prepared for defendants from the very beginning pointed out the problem of the 1960 quitclaim and alerted them their title may fail as a result unless they could cure the gap in title. And since all the operators of their agents who were defendants and investigated title were found to be bad faith trespassers by the jury and assessed punitive damages, meaning by definition they had no reasonable reliance on the status of their title. Also, there is no evidence that assets of Campbell, personally, were ever placed in Western to try to avoid Campbell's credit, which would be the proper analysis if this court were to consider a reverse alter ego case, such as this one. We have also briefed in detail why there is no evidence to support an alter ego finding, but we refer the court to our briefs with respect to that issue.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is now ready to hear argument from the sponsor.
May it please the court, Mr. Tom Scott, will present argument for the defendant.
Good
Police Court. The facts, perhaps those of you who were not here 5 years ago when it was argued would like to hear a brief accounting of some of the things that we think are significant in this case, because now they've gone through a trial court and they've been ruled on. We've got questions on it. We're not here on a summary judgment record. But the facts. Western had a farmhouse and a sign. Call it what you will. I assume these boards are here for something. I expect it will be pounded upon in the 8 minutes that remain. They took that assignment and drilled a well on it. Now, this isn't the assignment of Texas Company versus Davis, and it isn't the assignment of the Shuttle case, which may be mentioned later. It's the assignment that's on your desk. It's this assignment that was given to us, given to Western by a superior. And that is the controlling document in this case. The paragraphs that were granted on the summary judgment and that went up through the Court of Appeals and were before this court before were paragraphs 2 as brought forward by paragraph 7 of the document. There was an opinion there focused upon those issues. That opinion had grave problems. It was getting into substance of covenants, cancellation by covenants, matters that were noted in the last opinion of this court. At the time of presentation to this court, it occurred to counsel for the appellees at that time that the rule of Texas Company versus Davis controlled the case and that it could be affirmed at that time. It was argued from that standpoint. Yes, we do not deny that. I recall standing at this spot and arguing Texas Company versus Davis at length. Also, there is paragraph 5, which is a contractual statement of Texas Company versus Davis in this opinion. That was not ruled on by the Court of Appeals. It was not ruled on because it was expressly reserved. It was felt that there were fact issues involved with that paragraph that would have to be resolved on a trial. It was taken out by a briefing in the Court of Appeals. Clearly, it was not before the Court of Appeals. It was not before this court. The raw issue of Texas Company versus Davis was here. It was argued. That is a bedrock case of the law of Texas oil and gas. It was decided in 1923 on the day that 6 cases were laid down, including Stevens versus Mid-Kansas Oil and Gas, which decided once and for all that there was real property law in Texas. That real property law demanded, as the court properly noted last time, that there is no abandonment of title in Texas. On the same day that was handed down, there came down this reservation that there is abandonment of purpose. That if you abandon the purpose of a document that is granted on the consideration, on the thoughts, the purpose upon development and operations for oil and gas, if you walk away and leave that, there is an implied special limitation, not a covenant, not a condition, an implied special limitation that terminates the lease, just like the amendment clause, the lease, of the same dignity. It's given that by that case. Now, that came back to this court not long after in W.T. Wagner Estate versus Sigler Oil. And that is where the law was brought together and placed on the table and fought over for how long? For over 3 years from the time the Commission of Appeals wrote an opinion in it. Commissioner O.C. Spear wrote an opinion that was adopted by this court. That opinion was withdrawn, and the opinion that is now in the books took its place. If you want a contemporary view, a contemporary snapshot in time of what Texas Company versus Davis meant, and what that day meant, the place to get it is from the Commission of Appeals opinion. I regret I did not cite it in the supplemental brief, but in reading over the material, I see it. There, Justice Commissioner Spear sets it out, the law as he saw it, He applied it to give a partial termination of an oil and gas lease. That is what was reversed, the partial termination. His analysis of the law is the best analysis there is. It's a contemporary analysis. It spells out what those cases meant. And it's still the law of Texas. And that interest in Texas Company versus Davis terminated. What were the facts there? Quickly. Texas Company had a top lease. It was a topping an old 1901 lease taken within 6 months after Spindletop. They ran down the coast, leasing every bump on the coast. One of them was happened to be on top of the West Columbia Field. They drilled a 1,000-foot well, got a little production. It went away in 1915, after the war began. Texas Company went in, drilled another well, discovered the West Columbia Field. They were trespassers. If that lease were good, they were trespassers. They defended on the ground that that lease had terminated. It had a 20-year term after discovery of oil. So after that lease was cured. Everything had been done under it, no problems. It was a lease in place. Now, how does the appellant here distinguish that? The Rogers Group have a couple of attacks on it. One, it didn't involve a lease. This case does not involve a lease. It involves a partial assignment. Partial assignment. We are saying that the total estate created by that partial assignment terminated. It's a partial assignment, but it's the estate of that partial assignment that we're talking about. The title fell back to Superior. Superior had the title. It was theirs to do with as they pleased, and that's the case. That's what terminated. Let's go to paragraph 5 of this instrument. That is the writing of the parties on what it means. This was not before the court before. It talks in terms of if production ceases or is abandoned. Well, what happened? What did the Rogers Group do? In 1960, they drilled their well in 49. They got their production. It went down to nothing in 1961. They began to use it as an injector for saltwater water. Superior then objected or didn't object. I don't know. There was a dispute about that to a bit. They were in serious financial trouble. There's no question about that. The charter was canceled. The parties walked away from the lease. This gives Superior the right to demand a reassignment if they're given notice of the desire to abandon. That desire was manifest by the acts of the Western and its shareholders after the dissolution. Superior wrote two letters. Those letters are in the record demanding reassignments. They didn't get them. They did not follow up on it further. They sat back. Things went on. That demand, coupled with the principle of Texas Company versus Davis, which this is an embodiment of, terminates the estate. Now,
you began by saying, I don't care what you call this,
yeah,
a farm out or assignment, this is not a lease. But doesn't Texas Company versus Davis involve termination of a lease?
Yes, it is a lease.
So if you, I mean, isn't that a distinction between
that is a case and that? That is a distinction, but it is one without a difference. Look back at the two cases. The Thomason versus Ham case involves a lease. It was decided on the same day. Exactly the same sort of a situation. They had walked away, they'd left an assignment, they'd left a deed which was predicated upon doing drilling, and that estate terminated. The best statement, we've talked a lot
but
about...
But the difference is here, if you are tying up an estate and land, and the understanding of the parties in doing this is that there's going to be some production to the mutual benefit of the parties. and the party who receives the estate has something that the lease is for so long as you're operating on the lease. Doesn't Davis kind of fill in this, kind of the end term, which says we're not just going to have these leases last in perpetuity? There's got to be some ending here, and so in the context of oil and gas, we're just going to say these types of leases that are for as long as you are drilling, we're going to say that terminates. Doesn't it make a big difference if one is an estate plan and the other one is just a contractual right that I, as a leasehold owner here, I've got the leasehold interest here, and I want to share some of that with my partner over here, so I give them a portion of the lease? Isn't that a significant difference on the concept of Davis when you're dealing with simply an assignment of part of a lease as opposed to a leasehold?
Not in my view of it, John. The Davis creates an estate. This assignment creates an estate. It is an estate founded upon this document. It is an assignment estate. That was pointed out in the prior opinion, that an assignment creates an estate in land just like an oil and gas lease does. And I think that is good law. You've created another estate. Riley versus Meriwether, the case that we had, it was up here on application for rent. It created an estate. That estate terminated when the events in that terminate. It is an estate in oil and gas. It is you can have multiple estates, one following the other. This is supported by findings in the record. And the findings of the court below. We tried it to the jury. That was given to the jury as to whether there had been an abandonment, whether there had been a cessation of use. They found that there had been. Issues 9 and 10. In the Thomason versus Ham case, there is an express reference back to clauses like the second grammatical paragraph of paragraph 2. From Thomason against Ham, which again involved a deed that was based upon it. The abandonment of the enterprise, here's the clause that was in that court, in that case. The second part is the heirs and the assigns may at any time hereafter surrender up this grant and be relieved from any part of the contract heretofore entered into and may at that time remain unfulfilled. Gave them the right to abandon it, or to surrender it. The court said that regardless of regardless of this express surrender clause, we held today that estates vesting under grants with the sole purpose of mineral development made in view of promised royalties were limited in time. The principle applicable in controlling and preventing Thomason or his assigns from having any title in the minerals or the land in controversy. This grant, the grant of giving them the right, such grants plainly cannot endure after their voluntary relinquishment or abandonment. The surrender clause that's set out in that second paragraph, the court in Thomason says that it cannot survive after the parties walk away from it. And that's what they did. They walked away from it. They stayed away from it for 23 years. Yes, there was a deed out of Campbell, who had been president, that came down through the chain to the parties, and that was what was that is the start of the problem in this case. They were holding under that chain when the parties here began to raise the question. The Dallas Power and Light versus Cleghorn, that has been talked of as if it is a principle that is controlling in this case. We say it is not. Dallas Power and Light, you had a case there where there was coal and lignite case. The lessor was contending that they had the right to terminate to cease accepting delay rentals, because there was a perpetual rental payment, continuous out in time forever. They could pay delay rentals as long or rentals as long as they wished and not produce. There was a contention made that that rental clause could go on, could be stopped. There is clear law that it could be. There is law, there was A.W. Walker's article on it saying that you could stop it. Cleghorn holds that where you have an express covenant negating the right to do the thing you're wanting to do, then that clause overrides, the law overrides the implication. You cannot imply into the face of it. It does not say that you cannot supplement, you cannot amend. The Ham case, Thomason versus Ham, speaks expressly to these kinds of clauses which amplify and amend and give you the right to step in and fill in the gaps. And that is the purpose, that is a holding that is supports the paragraph 5 and goes to it.
What is your response to petitioner's argument that the defensive theories of ratification, estoppel, and reliance do not apply to this case?
There is a, it's not just, they ratified specifically, superiorly, into Meyer Maritz, one of the holders under this case. If you're talking about the chain of title or that kind of thing, that is not here. That, they ratified the Meyer Maritz, they recognized the title. It's supported by the facts of the case. Superior signed the division order. They recognized the title of these people that are claiming under them. They also recognized by the express ratification into those people. They have recognized the title of those that are claiming under them. The only thing that you have from Superior to Western and its shareholders is the demand for reassignment. There's no, it is not a ratification. It's a ratification case in that sense. It is a case where they have recognized the title. They've gone forward with the chain of title that's competing here. Before this ends, let me say one thing. Mobile should be out of this case. Mobile, there is a two, this is a conversion case as to the purchasers of Prude. Mobile and Southern Union were purchasing Prude. Mobile, the case was filed in April of 1984, 2 years back under the conversion statute is 82, April of 82. Discovery theory, discovery rule was argued. The issue was asked for. We objected. We fought the discovery rule back and forth. The finding they got on their issue was that they knew or should have known by January 1st, 1980, putting the date for that discovery rule out to 82. The bar date comes back to the 2 years before, which is April of 82. Everything Mobile purchased was prior to that date. Everything, a portion of what Southern Union purchased was before that date. That bar date should be recognized and written into this opinion if it is a remand. And we join wholeheartedly with the thought that this should not be a remand, that this case, this should be terminated at this time. And the thing to terminate it on are two things. Paragraph 5, which is the party's rendition of the rule against Texas Company versus Davis. It is recognized in the Ham case. The Shuttle case, which has not been mentioned, is a conceptualistic statement that there is no abandonment on assignment. That was written into the Shuttle case, but when you read the Shuttle case, when you get into it, there is an alternative holding. The alternative holding is, well, even if it does apply, it doesn't apply to these facts because Jake Hammond, the man who was the assignee in that case, they were claiming it abandoned. He was still on the job. He was doing his job. He was there. That is not the facts of our case. This has an importance. This isn't just some squirrely case in Cochran County. It is an important case because whatever is going to happen to the oil and gas industry, I think we can make these predictions. There's going to be a greater emphasis on technological things such as secondary recovery. There is going to be an emphasis on things like horizontal drilling, 3D seismic, that means you're going back into these old fields. You're fighting around, you're working around all kinds of estates. You don't know where these problems are coming from. They're not going to fall into neat packages. Everything isn't going to have oil and gas leases about farm out or assigned. You're going to have estates. And it is this rule, which has been around for 70 years, should not be limited. It should not be cut back. It should be preserved, and this is the case in which it is made for, and it should be applied. Thank you.
Any questions? Thank you, sir.
Not necessarily taking any of these points in any particular order, but first of all, with respect to Justice Heck's question regarding ratification, and every one of the points that has been mentioned by Mr. Scott is addressed in our brief, so if we don't respond to them, we do believe they're covered by our brief. But with respect to this ratification issue, the reason, and the record shows this, the reason that the assignments were ratified into some of the defendants, it's because the very first set of defendants who went to Superior misrepresented to Superior that they had obtained the title to Western's interest under the 1949 assignment. So Superior, in reliance upon those misrepresentations, believed that it was ratifying the assignment, this assignment over here in the hands of Superior, which is all that's necessary in terms of our issue of ratification and the fact that neither Superior nor the people who are claiming here are allowed under the doctrines of ratification and estoppel to now claim that this assignment has terminated, because for many years they took oil off the property, they represented to others they were claiming under this assignment, their abstracts of title in this case recited the 1949 assignment, they ratified their stop as a separate issue. Secondly, with respect to Justice Enoch's question, he was right, there is a strong difference between partial assignments of oil and gas leases on many grounds, and oil and gas leases themselves, basically. Not the least of which reasons is one that cuts right to the heart of defendant's argument, and that is with respect to the purposes, the respective different purposes of each type of document. It's not hard to see why an oil and gas lease, especially since they expressly state this and have for all those years, would require expiration, and then that by implication this court has read in covenants to oil and gas leases required continued development, but only if the other parties prove that there's reasonable expectation of profit and that sort of thing. So they contemplate additional drilling. Oil and gas farmout assignments, especially partial assignments of leases, and especially with respect to leases that are beyond their primary terms and so are being held by production, don't necessarily require additional drilling, don't necessarily have the same purposes as oil and gas leases. We cited the defendants.
What other purpose would they have?
Thank you for asking, Justice Spector. And that's where I was going with this exactly. 5 years ago when we were here, we cited an article by Professor John Lowe, who the defendants have added to their briefing in the last 2 weeks, which spells out a number of different purposes, only one of, at least seven, only one of which possibly involves continued production. In the context of a large oil and gas lease like this, where we're only claiming part and there's production from other parts. They mentioned many different types of purposes, and in the last week I was in Wyoming, and I have brought copies of this case today, and with the court's permission, I would like to give copies to defendants and leave with the clerk for the court a copy of a case, it's a slip opinion, out of Wyoming that says it better than I could ever say it. It's W.A. Moncrief, represented by Texas lawyers out of Fort Worth, versus Louisiana Land and Exploration and a number of other companies. And in that case, Amoco, who's one of the defendants in our case, was a far more, assigning out, like Superior Oil in this case, on 160 acres. And they had a provision like our paragraph 1 that required us to go drill, not required, but gave us the option, and that's what it says in here as well, to go drill a well, and if we drill that well, to adequately test a formation. It could be either a producer or a properly plugged non-commercial well or dry hole. So clearly, production is not the purpose there. Well, in this case, they had a similar paragraph that said it could be a plugged and abandoned well. And in that case, involving Amoco on a 160-acre farmout, court says, in 1990, and this is a recent one, in 1990, Moncrief obtained a commitment from Amoco to enter into a farmland agreement covering the 160-acre tract. Amoco's lease was not in danger of expiring if drilling was not expeditiously commenced. Rather, the lease was held by production. The parties agree that Amoco's purpose in entering into the farmout was to obtain geologic information. And they have a footnote here, and they cite to Professor Lowe's article and say, among the possible purposes for entering into a farmout are lease preservation, lease salvage, risk sharing, exploration and evaluation, access to market, obtaining reserves, and drilling an obligation well. And that's what we have here, is exactly that kind of express purpose. Because Texas over the last 60 years has developed, and we briefed this last time and we briefed it again this time, has developed a body of jurisprudence regarding oil and gas law that includes the held by production doctrine, the non-divisibility rule, which says unless there are express provisions otherwise, that when you, and this lease said the lease would be considered as an entirety even if it was assigned out in parts, that you don't divide up the obligations in the lease, and other doctrines. Lost my train of thought. I'm sorry. Because of those, to go back in and try and imply purposes and try and add express provisions to this assignment, I mean, try to imply in provisions where there are express termination provisions in here would violate all those other principles. And it's not necessary in a partial farmout assignment. Here in paragraph 2, we decided last time, this court decided last time, that whatever was covered by paragraph 2 was a covenant, was an obligation, so the remedy was not termination, it would be damages. And paragraph 2 includes drilling obligations, it includes the assumption of the obligations under the lease, express or implied, which would include the development obligations. They talk here about trying to pull out development obligations and drilling obligations, they're not to be found in this document. And if, catching back my train of thought, if Superior Oil could have held the entire lease by itself, there's no policy reason why they could not, in exchange for consideration, and Western did drill a well in 1949 as it was given the option to do, to earn this assignment, why they could not decide to farm out this 329-acre part to obtain geological information, or as the record indicates here, to basically cause Western to fulfill whatever obligation there might be to drill another well on this part of the lease, because the lessor was giving Superior a hard time about not drilling on all parts. And if Western went ahead and did that, there's no reason to take away their property when the express terms allowed them to keep it under a bargain for agreement, and the purposes of farm out assignments can be different just because defendants want to pull something out of the air and violate the rule of Fox versus Thorson, which is mentioned in this court's prior opinion. Thank you. Questions?
Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument in the first clause, and the court will now take a brief recess.